Chapter 7 Casting Loose 1 There was one guard pacing the dock at the base of the lonely island. His soft yellow lamp cast rippling light across the black water as Locke threw him a rope from within the little launch. Rather than tying them up, the guard thrust his lantern down toward Locke, Jean, and Caldris and said,
"This dock is strictly off... Oh, God, my apologies, sir."
Locke grinned, feeling the authority of the full Verari captain's uniform enfold him like nothing so much as a warm blanket. He grabbed a piling and heaved himself up onto the dock, while the guard saluted him awkwardly with his lantern hand crossed over his chest.
"Gods defend the Archon of Tal Verar," said Locke. "Carry on. It's your job to challenge strange boats at night, soldier."
While the soldier tied the launch to a piling, Locke reached down and helped Jean up. Moving gracefully in the now familiar costume, Locke then stepped around behind the dock guard, unfurled a leather crimper's hood from within his jacket, slammed it down over the soldier's head, and cinched the drawstring tight.
"God knows there's none stranger than ours that you're ever likely to see."
Jean held the soldier by his arms while the drugs inside the hood did their job. He lacked the constitution of the last man Locke had tried to knock out with such a hood, and sagged after just a few seconds of muffled struggle. When Locke and Jean tied him firmly to the piling at the far corner of the dock and stuffed a rag in his mouth, he was sleeping peacefully. Caldris clambered out of the boat, picked up the guard's lantern, and began pacing with it in his place. Locke stared up at the stone tower that was their objective. 7 stories tall, its battlements were orange-lit by alchemical navigation beacons warning ships away. Ordinarily, there would be guards up there as well, watching the waters and the dock. But the hand of Stragos was already at work. Nothing moved atop the tower.
"Come on, then," Locke whispered to Jean. "Let's get inside and do some recruiting."
2. "It's called Windward Rock," Stragos said. He pointed at the stone tower that jutted from the little island, perhaps a single arrow flight from the line of hissing white surf that marked Tal Verar's outer barrier of glass reefs. They floated at anchor in 70 feet of water, a good mile west of the Silver Marina. The warm morning sun was just rising over the city behind them, making tiers of soft light from its layers of foggy haze. True to Meraine's word, Stragos had arrived at dawn in a 30-foot launch of polished black wood, with comfortable leather seats at the stern and gold-gilded scrollwork on every surface. Locke and Jean were given the sails under Caldris' minimal supervision, while Meraine sat in the bow. Locke had wondered if she was ever comfortable anywhere else. They had sailed north, then rounded the Silver Marina and turned west, chasing the last blue shadow of the night sky on the far horizon. They rowed on for a few minutes, until Meraine whistled for everyone's attention and pointed to her left, across the starboard bow. A tall, dark structure could be seen rising above the waves in the distance. Orange lights glowed at its peak. Soon enough, they had dropped anchor to regard the lonely tower. If Stragos had no praise for Locke and Jean's handling of the vessel, neither did he offer any criticism.
"Windward Rock," said Jean. "I've heard of it. Some sort of fortress."
"A prison, Master de Ferrer."
"Will we be visiting it this morning?"
"No," said Stragos. "You'll be returning and landing soon enough. For now, I just wanted you to see it. And I wanted to tell you a little story. I have in my service a particularly unreliable captain, who has until now done a splendid job of concealing his shortcomings."
"Words cannot express how truly sorry I am to hear that," said Locke.
"He will betray me," said Stragos. "His plans for months have been leading up to a grand and final betrayal. He will steal something of great value from me and turn it against me for all to see."
"You should have been watching him more closely," Locke muttered.
"I have been," said Stragos, "and I am right now. The captain I speak of is you."
3. Windward Rock had only one set of doors, iron-bound, 11 feet tall, locked and guarded from the inside. A small panel in the wall beside them slid open as Locke and Jean approached, and a head silhouetted by lamplight appeared behind it. The guardswoman's voice was devoid of banter.
"Who passes?"
"An officer of Archon and Council," said Locke with ritual formality. "This man is my boatswain. These are my orders and papers." He passed a set of documents rolled into a tight tube to the woman behind the door. She slid the panel closed over her watchhole, and Locke and Jean waited in silence for several minutes, listening to the rushing passage of surf over the nearby reefs. Two moons were just coming up, gilding the southern horizon with silver, and the stars dusted the cloudless sky like confectioner's sugar thrown against a black canvas. Finally, there was a metallic clatter, and the heavy doors swung outward on creaking hinges. The guardswoman stepped out to meet them, saluting, but not returning Locke's papers.
"My apologies for the delay, Captain Ravel. Welcome to Windward Rock."
Locke and Jean followed her into the tower's entrance hall, which was divided into two halves by a wall of black iron bars running from floor to ceiling across its breadth. On the far side of these bars, a man behind a wooden desk had control of whatever mechanism closed the gates. They clattered shut behind Locke and Jean after a few seconds. The man, like the woman, wore the Archon's blue under-ribbed black leather armor, braces, vest, and neck guard. He was clean-shaven and handsome, and he waited behind the bars as the female guard approached to pass him Locke's papers.
"Captain Orin Ravel," she said, "and boatswain. Here with orders from the Archon."
The man studied Locke's papers at length before nodding and passing them back through the bars.
"Of course. Good evening, Captain Ravel. This man is your boatswain, Jerome Valora?"
"Yes, Lieutenant."
"You're to view the prisoners in the second vault? Anyone in particular?"
"Just a general viewing, Lieutenant."
"As you will."
The man slid a key from around his neck, opened the only gate set into the wall of iron bars, and stepped out toward them, smiling.
"We're pleased to render any aid the Protector requires, sir."
"I very much doubt that," said Locke, letting a stiletto slip into his left hand.
He reached out and gave the female guard a slash behind her right ear, across the unprotected skin between her leather neck guard and her tightly coiffed hair. She cried out, whirled, and had her blackened steel sabre out of its scabbard in an instant. Jean was tackling the male guard before her blade was even out. The man uttered a surprised choking noise as Jean slammed him against the bars and gave him a sharp chop to the neck with the edge of his right hand. The leather armor robbed the blow of its lethal possibilities without dulling the shock of impact. Gasping, the guard was easily pinned from behind by Jean, who immobilized his arms and held him in a grip like iron. Locke darted backward out of the female guard's reach as she slashed with her blade. Her first attack was swift and nearly accurate. Her second was a bit slower, and Locke had no trouble avoiding it. She readied a third swing and misstepped, tripping over her own feet. Her mouth hung open in confusion.
"You fucker," she muttered.
Poison.
Locke winced as she toppled face first to the stone floor. He'd meant to catch her, but the stuff on the blade was faster than he'd expected.
"You bastard,"
coughed the lieutenant, straining uselessly in Jean's hold.
"You killed her."
"Of course I didn't kill her, you twit. Honestly, you people, pull a blade anywhere around here and everyone assumes straight away that you've killed someone." Locke stepped up before the guard and showed him the stiletto. "Stuff on the edge is called Whitfrost. You have a good hard sleep all night. Wake up around noon, at which time you'll feel like hell. Apologies. So do you want it in the neck or in the palm of your hand?"
You God's damn traitor!"
"Neck it is." Locke gave the man his own shallow cut just behind his left ear and barely counted to 8 before he was hanging in Jean's arms, limper than wet silk. Jean set the lieutenant down gently and plugged a small ring of iron keys from his belt.
Right, said Locke. Let's pay a visit to the second vault.
4. Ravel didn't exist until a month ago, said Stragos. Not until I had you to build the lie around. A dozen of my most trusted men and women will swear after the fact that he was real, that they shared assignments and meals with him, that they spoke of duties and trifles in his company. My finickers have prepared orders, duty rosters, pay vouchers, and other documents, and seeded them throughout my archives. Men using the name of Ravel have rented rooms, purchased goods, ordered tailored uniforms delivered to the Sword Marina. By the time I'm dealing with the consequences of your betrayal, he'll seem real in fact and memory.
Consequences? Asked Locke.
Ravel is going to betray me just as Captain Bonaire betrayed me when she took my basilisk out of the harbor 7 years ago and raised a red banner. It's going to happen again, twice to the same Archon. I will be ridiculed in some quarters for a time. Temporary loss for long-term gain. He winced. Have you not considered the public reaction to what I'm arranging, Master Costa? I certainly have.
Gods, Maxillan, said Locke, toying absently with a knot on one of the lines bracing the vessel's relatively small mainsail. Trapped out at sea, feigning mastery in a trade for which I'm barely competent, fighting for my life with your fucking poison in my veins, I shall endeavour to keep you in my prayers for the sake of your hardship.
Ravel is an ass, too, said the Archon. I've had that specifically written into his back history. Now, something you should know about Tal Vahrar. The Priori's constables guard High Point Citadel Jail in the Castellana. The majority of the city's prisoners go there. But while Windward Rock is a much smaller affair, it's mine, manned and provisioned only by my people. The Archon smiled. That's where Ravel's treachery will reach the point of no return. That, Master Costa, is where you'll get your crew.
5. True to Stragos' warning, there was an additional guard to be disarmed in the first cell level beneath the entrance hall, at the foot of a wide spiral staircase of black iron. The stone tower overhead was for guards and alchemical lights. Windward Rock's true purpose was served by 3 ancient stone vaults that went down far beneath the sea into the roots of the island. The man saw them coming and took immediate alarm. No doubt Locke and Jean descending alone was a breach of procedure. Jean relieved him of his sword as he charged up the steps, kicked him in the face, and pinned him squirming on his stomach. Jean's month of exercise at Caldris Whim seemed to have left his strength more bullish than ever, and Locke almost pitied the poor fellow struggling beneath his friend. Locke reached over, gave the guard a touch of Whitfrost, and whistled jauntily. That was it for the night shift. A skeleton force with no cooks or other attendants. 1 guard at the docks, 2 in the entrance hall, 1 on the first cell level. The 2 on the roof, by Stragos' direct order, would have sipped drugged tea and fallen asleep with the pot between them. They'd be found by their morning relief with a plausible excuse for their incapacity, and another lovely layer of confusion would be thrown over the whole affair. There were no boats kept at Windward Rock itself. So even if prisoners could conceivably escape from iron-barred cells set into the weeping walls of the old vaults and win free through the barred entrance hall and lone reinforced door, they'd face a swim across a mile of open water, at least, watched with interest by many things in the depths eager for a meal. Locke and Jean ignored the iron door leading to the cells of that first level, continuing down the spiraling staircase. The air was dank, smelling of salt and unwashed bodies. Past the iron door on the second level, they found themselves in a vault divided into 4 vast cells, long and low-ceilinged, 2 on each side with a 15-foot corridor down the middle. Only one of these cells was actually occupied. Several dozen men lay sleeping in the pale green light of barred alchemical globes set high on the walls.
The air in here was positively rank, dense with the odours of unclean bedding, urine, and stale food. Faint tendrils of mist curled around the prisoners. A few wary pairs of eyes tracked Locke and Jean as they stepped up to the cell door. Locke nodded to Jean, and the bigger man began to pound his fist against the bars of the door. The clamour was sharp, echoing intolerably from the dripping walls of the vault. Disturbed prisoners rose from their dirty pallets, swearing and hollering.
"Are you men comfortable in there?"
Locke shouted to be heard above the din. Jean ceased his pounding.
"We'd be lots more comfortable with a nice sweet Ferrari captain in here for us to fuck sideways,"
said a prisoner near the door.
"I have no patience to speak of," said Locke, pointing at the door he and Jean had come through. "If I walk back out that door, I won't be coming back."
"Piss off, then, and let us sleep,"
said a scarecrow of a man in a far corner of the cell.
"And if I won't be coming back," said Locke, "then none of you poor bastards will ever find out why Vaults 1 and 3 have prisoners in every cell, while this one is completely empty save for yourselves."
That got their attention. Locke smiled.
"That's better. My name is Orin Ravel. Until a few minutes ago, I was a captain in the Navy of Tal Varar. And the reason you're here is because I selected you. Every last one of you. I selected you, and then I forged the orders that got you assigned to an empty cell vault.
6.
I chose 44 prisoners originally," said Stragos. They stared at Windward Rock in the light of the morning sun.
A boat of blue-coated soldiers was approaching it in the distance, presumably to relieve the current shift of guards.
"I had the second cell vault cleared, except for them. All the orders signed Ravel are plausible, but upon scrutiny, the signs of forgery will become evident. I can use that later as a plausible excuse to arrest several clerks whose loyalties aren't straightforward enough for my taste."
"Efficient," said Locke.
"Yes," Stragos continued. "These prisoners are all prime seamen, taken from ships that were impounded for various reasons. Some have been in custody for a few years. Many are actually former crewmen of your Red Messenger, lucky not to be executed along with their officers. Some of them might even have past experience at piracy."
"Why keep prisoners at the Rock?" asked Jean. "In general, I mean."
"Or fodder," answered Caldris. "Handy thing to keep on hand. War breaks out, they'll be offered full pardons if they agree to work as galley rowers for the duration. The Rock tends to have a couple galleys worth most of the time."
"Caldris is entirely correct," said Stragos.
"Now, as I said, some of those men have been in there for several years, but none of them have ever had to endure conditions like those of the past month. I have had them deprived of everything from clean bedding to regular meals. The guards have been cruel, disturbing their sleeping hours with loud noises and buckets of cold water. I dare say by now that there isn't a man among them that doesn't hate Windward Rock, hate Tal Varar, and hate me, personally."
Locke nodded slowly. "And that's why you expect them to greet Ravel as their savior."
7. "You're the one responsible for shoving us into this hell, you fucking Ferrari asslicker!"
One of the prisoners stepped up to the bars and clutched them. The depredations of the cell vault had yet to whittle away a build frighteningly close to that of the heroic statuary of old. Locke guessed he was a recent arrival. His muscles looked carved from witchwood. His skin and hair were black enough to shrug off the pale green light, as though in disdain.
"I'm the one responsible for moving you to this vault," said Locke. "I didn't lock you up in the first place. I didn't arrange for the treatment you've been receiving."
"Treatment's a fancy fucking word for it."
"What's your name?"
"Jabril."
"Are you in charge?"
"Of what?"
Some of the man's anger seemed to ebb, transmuting to tired resignation.
Nobody's in fucking charge behind iron bars, Captain Ravel. We piss where we sleep. We don't keep bloody muster rolls or duty shifts.
You men are all sailors, said Locke.
Was sailors, said Jabril.
I know what you are. You wouldn't be here otherwise. Think about this. Thieves get let out. They go to West Citadel. They work at hard labor. They slave until they rupture or get pardoned. But even they get to see the sky. Even their cells have windows. Debtors are free to go when their debts are paid. Prisoners of war go home when the war's over. But you poor bastards, you're penned up here against need. You're cattle. If there's a war, you'll be chained to oars. And if there's no war, well,
there's always war, said Jabril.
7 years since the last one, said Locke. He stepped up to the bars just across from Jabril and looked him in the eyes. Maybe 7 years again, maybe never. You really want to grow old in this vault, Jabril?
What's the bloody alternative, Captain?
Some of you came from a ship, said Locke, impounded recently. Your captain tried to smuggle in a nest of stiletto wasps.
The fortunate venture, aye, said Jabril. We was promised high heaps of gold for that job.
Fucking things killed 8 men on the voyage, said another prisoner. We thought we'd inherit their shares.
Turns out they was lucky, said Jabril. They didn't have to take no share of this god's damned place.
The fortunate venture is riding at anchor in the Sword Marina, said Locke. She's been rechristened the Red Messenger. Refurbished, resupplied, careened and smoked. She's been prettied up. The Archon means to take her into his service.
Good for the bloody Archon.
I'm to command her, said Locke. She's at my disposal. I have the keys, as it were.
What the fuck do you want, then?
It's 12:30, said Locke, lowering his voice to a stage whisper that echoed dramatically to the back of the cell.
Morning relief won't arrive for more than 6 hours, and every guard on Windward Rock is currently unconscious.
The entire cell was full of wide eyes. Men heaved themselves up from their sleeping pallets and pressed closer to the bars, forming an unruly but attentive crowd.
I am leaving Talvarar tonight, said Locke. This is the last time I will ever wear this uniform. I am quits with the Archon and everything he stands for. I mean to take the Red Messenger, and for that I need a crew.
The mass of prisoners exploded into a riot of shoving and jabbering. Hands thrust out at Locke through the bars, and he stepped back.
I'm a top man, one of the prisoners yelled. Fine top man! Take me!
9 years at sea, hollered another. Do anything!
Jean stepped up and pounded on the cell door again, bellowing,
Quiet!
Locke held up the ring of keys Jean had taken from the lieutenant in the entrance hall.
I sail south on the Sea of Brass, he said. I make for Port Prodigal. This is not subject to vote or negotiation. You sail with me, you sail under the red flag. You want off when we reach the Ghost Winds, you can have it. Until then, we're on the watch for money and plunder. No room for shirkers. The word is equal shares.
That would give them something to ponder, Locke thought. A freebooter captain more commonly took 2 to 4 shares from 10 of any plunder got at sea. Just the thought of equal shares for all would quell a great many mutinous urges.
Equal shares, he repeated above another sudden outburst of babble. But you make your decision here and now. Take oath to me as your captain and I will free you immediately. I have means to get you off this rock and over to the Red Messenger. We'll have hours of darkness to clear the harbour and be well away. If you don't want to come, fine. But no courtesies in that case. You'll stay here when we're gone.
Maybe the Morning Relief will be impressed with your honesty, but I doubt it. Who among you will desist? None of the prisoners said anything. Who among you will go free and join my crew? Locke winced at the eruption of shouts and cheers, then allowed himself a wide, genuine grin.
All gods as your witness, he shouted, upon your lips and upon your hearts.
Our oath is made, said Jabril, while those around him nodded.
Then stand upon it, or pray to die, and be damned and found wanting on the scales of the Lady of the Long Silence.
So we stand, came a chorus of shouts.
Locke passed the ring of keys over to Jean. The prisoners watched in an ecstasy of disbelief as he found the proper key, slid it into the lock, and gave it a hard turn to the right.
8. There is one problem, said Stragos.
Just one?
Locke rolled his eyes.
There are only 40 left of the 44 I selected.
How will that suit the needs of the ship?
We've got food and water for 100 days with 60, said Caldris, and she can be handled well with half that number. Once we've got them sorted out, we'll do fine for hands at the lines.
So you will, said Stragos. The missing 4 are women. I had them placed in a separate cell. One of them developed a jail fever, and soon they all had it. I had no choice but to move them to shore. They're too weak to lift their arms, let alone join this expedition.
We're for sea with not a woman aboard, said Caldris. Will not Meraine be coming with us then?
I'm afraid, she said sweetly, that my talents will be required elsewhere.
This is mad, cried Caldris. We taunt the Father of Storms.
You can find women for your crew in Port Prodigal, perhaps even good officers.
Stragos spread his hands.
Surely you'll be fine for the duration of a single voyage down.
Would that it were mine to so declare,
said Caldris, a haunted look in his eyes.
Master Costa, this is a poor way to start. We must have cats, a basket of cats for the Red Messenger. We need what luck we can steal. All gods as your witness, you must not fail to have cats at that ship before we put to sea.
Nor shall I, said Locke.
Then it's settled, said Stragos. Heed this now, Costa. Concerning the depth of your deception, in case you have any misgivings, none of the men you'll be taking from Windward Rock have ever served in my navy, so they've little notion of what to expect from one of my officers, and soon enough you'll be Revel the pirate rather than Revel the naval captain, so you may tailor the impersonation as you see fit and worry little over small details.
That's good, said Locke. I've got enough of those crammed into my head just now.
I have one last stipulation, Stragos continued. The men and women who serve at Windward Rock, even those who are not party to this scheme, are among my finest and most loyal. I will provide means for you to disable them without rendering permanent harm. In no way are they to be otherwise injured, not by you nor your crew, and gods help you if you leave any dead.
Curious sentiments for a man who claims to be no stranger to risks.
I would send them into battle at any time, Costa, and lose them willingly, but none who wear my colours honestly are to die as part of this. That much my honour compels me to grant them. You are supposed to be professionals. Consider this a test of your professionalism.
We're not bloody murderers, said Locke. We kill for good reason, when we kill at all.
So much the better, said Stragos. That is all I have to say, then. This day is yours to do with as you see fit. Tomorrow evening, just before midnight, you'll land on Windward Rock and start this business.
We need our antidote, said Locke. Jean and Caldris nodded.
Of course. You three will get your last vials just before you leave. After that, I shall expect your first return within 2 months and a report of your progress.
9. Locke and Jean managed a ragged muster of their new crew just inside the entrance hall. Jean had to demonstrate his physical strength to several men who attempted to vent their frustrations on the sleeping guards.
"I said you touched them at your peril!" Locke snarled for the third time. "Let them be! If we leave them dead behind us, we'll lose all sympathy with anyone. Let them live, and Varari will be laughing about this for months to come!"
"Now," he said, "move out quietly to the dockside. Take your ease, stretch your legs, have a good long look at the sea and sky. I have a boat to fetch before we can be away. For the sake of us all, keep your mouths shut." They mostly obeyed this admonition, breaking up into little whispering groups as they moved out of the tower. Locke noticed that some of the men hung back near the door, their hands on the stones, as though afraid to step out beneath the open sky. He couldn't say he blamed them after months or years in the vault.
"That's lovely," said Jabril,
who fell into step beside Locke as they approached the dock where Caldris paced with his lantern.
"Fucking lovely. Almost as lovely as not having to smell us all at once."
"You'll be crammed together again soon enough," said Locke.
"Aye, same but different."
"Jabril," said Locke, raising his voice, "in time, as we come to know one another's strengths, we can hold proper votes for some of the officers we'll need. For now, I'm naming you acting mate."
"Mate of what?"
"Mate of whatever." Locke grinned and slapped him on the back. "I'm not in the Navy anymore, remember? You'll answer to Jerome. Keep the men in order. Take the weapons from that soldier tied to the dock, just in case we need to pull a little steel this evening. I don't expect a fight, but we should be ready."
"Good evening, Captain Ravel," said Caldris. "I see you fetched them out just as you planned."
"Aye," said Locke. "Jabril, this is Caldris, my sailing master. Caldris, Jabril is acting mate under Jerome. Listen up." Locke raised his voice without shouting, lest it echo across the water to unseen ears. "I came with a boat for 6. I have a boat for 40 nearby. I need 2 men to help me row. Won't be half an hour, and then we'll be away."
2 younger prisoners stepped forward, looking eager for anything that would relieve the tedium of what they'd been through.
"Right," said Locke, as he stepped down into their little boat, after Caldris and the 2 sailors. "Jerome, Jabril, keep order and quiet. Try to sort out those who can work right away from those who will need a few days to recover their strength."
Anchored half a mile out from Windward Rock was a long launch, invisible in the moonlight until Caldris' lantern found it from about 50 yards away. Locke and Caldris worked quickly to rig the boat's small sail. Then, slowly but surely, they steered their way back toward the prison with the 2 ex-prisoners rowing the little boat beside them. Locke glanced around nervously, spotting a sail or 2 gleaming palely on the far horizons, but nothing closer.
"Listen well," he said, when the launch was tied up below the dock and surrounded by his would-be crew.
He was pleasantly surprised at how quickly they'd settled down to the business at hand. Of course, that made sense. They were the crews of impounded ships, not hard cases imprisoned for individual crimes. It didn't make saints of them, but it was nice to have something unforeseen working in his favor for once.
"Able hands, take the oars. Don't be shy if you're less than able for the time being. I know some of you have been down there too damn long. Just sit down in the middle of the launch and take it easy. You can recover yourselves on the voyage out. We've plenty to eat."
That lent them some cheer. Once at sea, Locke knew, the state of their rations might easily approach that of the prison slop they were leaving behind, but for a fair few days they'd have a supply of fresh meat and vegetables to look forward to. In good order, the former prisoners clambered aboard the launch. Soon the gunwales were lined with those claiming to be able-bodied, and oars were being slipped into their locks. Jabril took the bow, waving up at Locke and Caldris when all was in readiness.
"Right," said Locke. "The messenger is anchored south of the Sword Marina on the seaward side, wanting nothing save her crew. One guard stands watch for the night, and I'll deal with him. Just follow us and go aboard once I've done that. The nets are lowered over the side and the defences are stowed."
Locke took the bow of the small boat and struck what he hoped was an appropriately regal posture. Jean and Caldris took the oars, and the last two prisoners sat at the stern, one of them holding Caldris' lantern.
"Say farewell to Windward Rock, boys," said Locke, "and bid fuck you to the Archon of Tal Verar. We're bound for sea."
10. A shadow within shadows watched the two boats depart. Meraine moved out of her position beside the tower and gave a small wave as the low grey shapes diminished into the south. She loosed the black silk scarf that had covered her lower face and pushed back the hood of her black jacket. She had lain in the shadows beside the tower for nearly 2 hours, waiting patiently for Costa and Deferra to finish their business. Her own boat was stashed beneath a rocky overhang on the east side of the island, little more than a cockleshell of treated leather over a wood frame. Even in moonlight, it was all but invisible on the water. She padded quietly into the entrance hall of the prison, finding the two guards, much where she expected, carelessly strewn about in the grip of Whitfrost sleep. True to the Archon's wishes, Costa and Deferra had prevented anyone from harming them.
"Alas for that," she whispered,
kneeling over the lieutenant and running a gloved finger across his cheeks.
"You're a handsome one."
She sighed, slipped a knife from its sheath within her jacket, and cut the man's throat with one quick slash. Moving back to avoid the growing pool of blood, she wiped the blade on the guard's breeches and contemplated the woman lying across the entrance hall. The two atop the tower could live. It wouldn't be plausible for anyone to have climbed the stairs and gone for them. But she could do the one on the dock, the two here, and the one who was supposed to be downstairs. That would be enough, she reckoned. It wasn't that she desired Costa and Deferra to fail, but if they did return successful in their mission, what was to stop Stragos from assigning them to another task? His poison made tools of them indefinitely. And if they could return victorious, well, men like that were better off dead if they couldn't be put to use on behalf of the interests she served. Resolved, she set about finishing the job. The thought that for once it would be entirely painless was a comfort in her work.